This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhiman. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
we were hearing about cases of killings and rapes and arrests, arbitrary arrests and detentions. And during the course of our stay in Yeh, we were able to confirm pretty much all of this.
That's Jonathan Penno of Human Rights Watch describing conditions in the South Sudanese city of Yeh. Details coming up.
Also, officials in Nigeria's Chibok area say their town is under siege as Boko Haram fighters attack. And the court case against five war veterans who had denounced President Robert Mugabe has been dismissed.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Human Rights Watch says both government and rebel forces in South Sudan have killed, raped, arbitrarily arrested, and abducted civilians in the city of Yeh. It's in the central Equatoria region, about 150 kilometers south of the capital, Juba. HRW says attacks on civilians have intensified since July, following fighting in and around Juba. Jonathan Pinot is a researcher in Human Rights Watch's Africa division. He recently visited Yeh. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua about conditions in Yeh.
Yeh has become very much of a town under occupation. There are soldiers everywhere with AK-47, with RPGs. One walks around and never really knows what may happen. You know, we've had mornings waking up the sound of mortar shelling just a few kilometers outside of town. It's definitely a very tense situation for what used to be one of South Sudan's most stable towns, a place where people were sending their kids to study, a place where all the 64 ethnicities of South Sudan were living along together.
Now, Human Rights Watch makes some serious allegations regarding both government soldiers and rebels in Yeh. Tell us about those.
Yeah, so we visited Yeh because we were hearing about a lot of atrocious stories coming from refugees who had fled Yeh and the regions around Yeh to Uganda. We were hearing about cases of killings and rapes and arrests, arbitrary arrests and detentions. And during the course of our stay in Yeh, we were able to confirm pretty much all of this. So more precisely, I mean, we found that the government forces who are still in control of the city of Yeh had been arresting and detaining scores of young men on the pretense that they may be rebels and had been subjecting them to horrific detention conditions with very little food, very little water, with a number of detainees as well who unfortunately died as a result of those horrendous conditions. We also found that soldiers had killed a number of civilians. Soldiers went into certain areas of town and forcefully displaced civilians, and now civilians who venture back into those areas, some of them have unfortunately been killed. Women have been raped. But that's only for the government side, because rebels around Yeh have also committed abuses against civilians. We've heard of cases of rape of women, often on the basis of ethnicity, with the rebels targeting Dinka civilians, but also Sudanese refugees who are seen as being on the side of the government. There has been a horrific attack, unfortunately, on October 8th on a convoy of civilians that was fleeing Yeh to Juba. Most of them Dinka, most of them women and children, and, you know, rebels attacked one of the trucks and then set it on fire, killing dozens, mostly women and children.
About how many people did Human Rights Watch interview for this report?
So we interviewed about 70 victims and witnesses and people from the local civil society in Yeh.
You visited Yeh in October. Have you received any updates on the situation since?
Yes, the situation unfortunately continues to deteriorate. A journalist from the Associated Press reported just recently that there had been a massacre just a mere few days after we left. 11 farmers were coming back from the market in Yeh and were captured by gunmen, unclear whether they were government or rebels, then brought to a hut, killed, and then the hut was burnt.
Is Human Rights Watch calling for any specific actions?
We think an arms embargo should be put in place now. The United States has announced recently that it was going to circulate a draft proposal for an arms embargo at the UN Security Council. We're still seeing a little bit of reluctance on the part of some of the council members. We've also been advocating for individual sanctions, sanctioning of commanders that are seen as responsible for some of those horrendous acts, but that will not provide justice. So sanctions are a temporary measure, but we've been calling for a hybrid court to be established in the first place to investigate and prosecute the war crimes and international crimes that we've seen in South Sudan since 2013. And the African Union is supposed to take charge of that. And despite receiving funding from the U.S. and other countries, unfortunately, we're seeing that the African Union is not moving nearly as fast as we would like it to do. So we're calling for all interested parties to continue to put pressure on the African Union to make sure that this court sees the light of day soon enough.
Jonathan Pinot is a researcher in Human Rights Watch's Africa division. He spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua.
The Human Rights Watch report detailing abuses by government and rebel forces against civilians in Yei was met with skepticism from SPLA Army spokesman Lul Ruai. Ruai, who has not yet seen the report, tells reporter Ayan Bior that there is no evidence of the alleged crimes against civilians committed by his soldiers.
I'm yet to see the report that they have released. However, I would like to make it very clear that this is not a new allegation. They have been accusing SPLA from time to time of alleged atrocities, and we have been challenging them to give us the evidence so that we could go against those who are involved in the reported atrocities. Having said that, in the last 2 to 3 months, we have been reporting about atrocities that are being committed against civilians by the rebels. So I'm surprised to hear that the government is being accused as well.
There are South Sudanese witnesses and South Sudanese victims themselves who have come forth and said, these are the crimes that have been committed against me and my family. Do their voices not matter?
Their voices do matter. But of course, without us hearing from them so that we go against their abuses, it would be difficult for us to take the accusation at face value.
What attempts has the government made to hear some of the voices of the victims who are crying and saying that their own government is attacking them?
In July, in Wau, some SPLA soldiers were accused of having killed a couple. When we did our investigation, we found out that they did just that. We took very drastic measures against them. We also did the same to SPLA soldiers who were accused of having committed illegal acts against our civilians in Juba. We sentenced some of our own soldiers to death by firing squad. We dismissed some from military service, and we sentenced some to long-term prison sentences. These were the steps we took after establishing that indeed some of our own servicemen, took part in committing atrocities.
Among the soldiers of the SPLA, what is the protocol of acting with civilians? Because again, as this report points out, it seems as if there is a trend of violence targeting civilians.
I would say no. I don't concur with that finding or with that conclusion. What we have been saying is that yes, from time to time we heard reports of some of our servicemen being accused of doing this and that, and the serious accusations we heard were in Wau, like I said earlier on, and in Juba here. And we took good steps meant at ensuring that civilians are not targeted by SPLA soldiers. We took some good steps, and the steps are still, the preventive mechanisms we put in place are still in place, and they have not been violated. They have not been violated since July. What we are saying is there are violations by SPLA soldiers, and those who are having the evidence of them, let them come forward. There is no trend from our side. There were isolated cases here and there, and those cases were sufficiently addressed.
That was SPLA Army spokesman Lual Ruai speaking earlier today to VOA's Ayan Bior from Washington.
Mm-hmm. Government officials in Nigeria's Chibok area say their town is under siege as Boko Haram fighters have razed 9 nearby villages in the last 2 weeks. Reports of renewed attacks at the site of the 2015 kidnapping of more than 270 schoolgirls now raise fears of a resurgence of Boko Haram destruction in Borno State. The attacks occurred on the fringes of the Sambisa Forest. That's an area where the Nigerian military says it has contained remnants of the rebel force that terrorized much of Nigeria's northeast for 7 years. Despite military claims that Boko Haram is on the run, Chibok leaders say these attacks hint of more raids to come as the rainy season ends. In other news, UN humanitarian coordinator for the Sahel, Toby Lanzer, says he does not think the security crisis is anywhere near over. Lanzer estimates 100,000 people have been uprooted in the swamplands of the vast Lake Chad Basin. Humanitarian aid workers report that the livelihoods of hundreds of thousands of more are threatened.
In Libya, forces loyal to the UN-backed Government of National Accord continue their assault on the city of Sirte. With the help of U.S. airstrikes, they've been trying since August to dislodge Islamic State fighters who've used the city as their stronghold. AP reports government forces are closing in on the city's Giza district, but are facing snipers, car bombs, and booby traps. Islamic State seized Sirte more than a year ago.
Researchers say that giving anti-malarial drugs to older children can significantly reduce overall transmission of disease. Currently, most such programs are limited to the under fives, but a study by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, shows that expanding the intervention can lower the number of malaria cases. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
The World Health Organization estimates there were 214 million new cases of malaria in 2015 and 438,000 deaths, with by far the majority of fatalities in sub-Saharan Africa. In Senegal, health workers from charities like Speak Up Africa have been testing a new approach, giving preventative anti-malarial drugs to children up to the age of 10 during the rainy season when malaria prevalence is highest. It's known as seasonal malaria chemoprevention, or SMC. Researchers from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine conducted a study of 200,000 children in the programme. Professor Paul Milligan led the investigation.
The treatments then have to be repeated at strictly four-week intervals, and that's quite challenging in terms of implementing that in rural Africa. But despite that, countries have been quick to adopt this new approach.
And it's showing results. In Senegal, the SMC program more than halved cases of malaria in children under 10. It also reduced cases in those above 10 years of age by a quarter by helping to reduce transmission of the disease.
By expanding the age range, one is then treating a larger fraction of the parasite reservoir, which is the source of infection to mosquitoes.
The SMC program has been rolled out to 11 countries, reaching about 15 million children up to the age of 5 in 2016. Professor Milligan says the latest results show the programs should be expanded to include older children.
What we found was that if you're going door to door, it doesn't take much extra time to treat older children. And that if you go out of school hours, then you can get high coverage even during term time.
Milligan says the next step is to identify other parts of Africa that could benefit from expanding the SMC programme to older children. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 19 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Both government and rebel forces in South Sudan have committed gross human rights abuses, according to Human Rights Watch. And officials in Nigeria's Chibok area say their town is under siege as Boko Haram fighters attack. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Zimbabwe's case against five war veterans for denouncing President Robert Mugabe has been dismissed. Judge Jose Mujaha in Harare rejected a third request to delay the prosecution. He told government lawyers if they want to try the case in his court, they will have to start over. The five accused are elected leaders of the Zimbabwe National Liberation War Veterans Association. They publicly called the 92-year-old Mugabe a dictator and said they would no longer vote for him. War veterans had been loyal supporters of Mr. Mugabe since he was elected in 1987. However, his economic policies gave popularity criticized as the nation runs out of cash and street protests have increased.
The United Nations is making contingency plans to respond to a sudden increase in humanitarian needs should the Democratic Republic of Congo's political situation turn violent. From the United Nations, VOA's Margaret Bashir has more.
The UN has been warning for several months that without a serious national political dialogue, tensions in the DRC could deteriorate into a severe and possibly violent crisis. The UN has some 20,000 peacekeepers in the country's volatile east and has been conducting military contingency planning to protect civilians if the situation escalates. On Tuesday, the mission's humanitarian and resident coordinator, Mamadou Diallo, told a small group of member states that his team is also preparing should there be election-related violence or mass displacement.
If these things happen, we have a contingency plan, which is built around what we have called the hotspots, places where we anticipate that political strife will happen because they are opposition strongholds or there is a history of political conflict in these places.
The DRC has been a focus of humanitarian efforts for the past two decades due to internal conflicts and natural disasters, and as recipient of refugees from its neighbors. Currently, Diallo said the country is coping with yellow fever and cholera epidemics and is close to eradicating a measles outbreak. The UN appealed for nearly $700 million for humanitarian needs in DRC this year, but has just received over half the amount, enabling it to assist almost 6 million people. Diallo said they expect nearly 8 million Congolese to need aid next year. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
A group of university leaders is meeting in Nairobi this week to discuss issues affecting college students in Kenya, including violence, radicalization, and violent extremism at universities. From the University of Nairobi, VOA's Jill Craig has more.
For Kenyan college students, the university experience involves more than just term papers, final exams, and all-night study sessions. Young people are also discussing the problems of violent extremism and radicalization at their universities, which they say is a real concern here. Linda Ochiel is the commissioner of Kenya's National Cohesion and Integration Commission.
It's not mad people that become radicalized. It's people like yourselves. People that dress every day neatly like a dresser are the people that get radicalized. It is not those people that you think, for example, have not gone to school properly.
Ochiel was speaking to about 60 university leaders from around Kenya who assembled at the University of Nairobi Wednesday to discuss issues affecting college students. Radicalization and youth violent extremism were key topics. Victor Uhuru is the founder and president of the Youth Advancement Initiative, the group organizing the three-day event.
Radicalization is as a result of the disappointment young people are going through. That's why they are vulnerable to these violent groups. So we feel that if these young people are also helped because the economic opportunity has also been becoming so small. We want them to learn other ways of survival.
Delegate Susan Mwangi says that in Kenya, university students have felt the effects of terrorism firsthand, citing the April 2015 Garissa University attack that killed 147 students. But she says there are other implications of such terror.
Yeah, if you lose a loved one, it affects us. It also affects our economy. It affects the image of our country to the rest of the world. When we hear about every news television is talking about Kenyans' terrorist attack, it affects us even morally when we lose our friends.
Ochiel urged university students to stay vigilant against propaganda, the exploitation of religious teachings, and ethnocentrism.
So some of the targets of radicalization and violent extremism, how these people recruit us, they go to institutions, formal institutions like universities. And you know what they are doing right now? They are looking for the brightest of students. So you guys are actually a target.
Ochiel says radicalization does not just happen with terrorist groups like Al-Shabaab and ISIS. She argues that politicians and others incite young people to violence against different ethnic groups when it suits their political purposes, especially during election periods. And Kenya's elections are fast approaching in August 2017. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
As Americans recognize the Thanksgiving holiday this week, a local group brings volunteers and community members together with their newly resettled refugee neighbors for a special type of Thanksgiving dinner. Elizabeth Chernev reports.
This isn't your typical Thanksgiving, but here in Arlington, Virginia, friends and families of recently arrived refugees are coming together, sharing a taste of a quintessential American holiday.
I'm really happy to work with refugees.
Kiddis Tesfai moved to the United States with help from the Ethiopian Community Development Council, a nonprofit group helping refugees find jobs, schools, and places to live. Tonight's Thanksgiving meal is meant to welcome newcomers, some who arrived here only within the last month.
The aim of the program is we give them the love, we give them the American opportunity. America is for everyone, so we give them that love for them. That's the dinner program.
Coming together around the table, this Thanksgiving dinner is a multicultural buffet of sorts.
I think this is my fifth or sixth Thanksgiving.
Sadiq Ali Hedri, originally from Pakistan, is here with his 19-year-old daughter. Across the room, Chandra from Sri Lanka is all smiles.
Very nice, very nice. So many people I see ready, the different country people I see ready, and different food I see ready.
You won't find political squabbling around these tables, only people enjoying good company and good food.
When people share food, an extraordinary thing happens. All of a sudden people find out they have more in common than their differences.
Embracing those differences, according to ECDC's director, is part of what has helped the program thrive over the past 30 years.
Our role in refugee settlement is integrating them into the community. There is no better way of introducing Thanksgiving as part of the integration process.
Together, these families, hopeful for the future, break bread as part of an American tradition. Elizabeth Chernoff, VOA News, Arlington, Virginia.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC.
For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanoff, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Joyce Banda, the former president of Malawi. She'll discuss what Africa can learn from the U.S. elections and the peaceful transition of power from one leader to another. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.